Welcome to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on the program this week, building artificial beaver dams to restore streams. And jazz pianist prodigy Connor Rohrer talks about his start in music and his most recent tour with Samara Joy, a triple Grammy winner. Sometimes nature has the best solutions. Beavers build dams to create homes for themselves. Beaver dams back up small streams of moving water to protect themselves from enemies. However, beaver dams can also make a stream healthier by reducing erosion and raising water levels. Humans are recreating what the beaver has done through something called beaver dam analogs, or artificial beaver dams. Susquehanna University's Freshwater Research Institute has created their own beaver dams in an effort to restore streams. And Director Matt Wilson joins us on the Spark today. Professor Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, I got to tell you right off the bat, the beaver dam analog sounds so detached or distant, too scientific. What do you really call them?
BDAs, obviously.
That's even more detached. Let's just go with artificial beaver dams, okay?
We can live with that, yeah.
Okay. So why build artificial beaver dams?
Because we eliminated all the beavers, that's why. And, you know, the short version is that, right? Streams in North America 500 years ago, they were all wetlands, slow flowing, meandering. You know, we had beavers every 100 meters, every 100 yards or so. Now, our idea, our aesthetic of what a healthy stream looks like is this narrow single channel that flows through a beautiful forest. That's not always what it was.
Mm. Really, I did not realize that 500 years ago we had that many beavers, and obviously our streams, our waterways, were much healthier at that time. So beavers had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, you can think about, I like to create an analogy of beavers really created the kidneys of our watersheds, you know. These dams, these ponds that they created, filtered out sediment. They filtered out anything that was flowing in off the landscape. And so now that we've removed those and increased nutrients, we've doubled the problem.
Okay, so you said that the reason to build artificial beaver dams is because we don't have real beavers building them any longer. So what's the motivation? What's the incentive? What's the reason behind building an artificial beaver dam?
Yeah, so for me, I really came to this a few years ago thinking about, it's real common out west to build beaver dam analogs now. And they started doing that about 15, 20 years ago. But it just hasn't caught on in the east. And we have a stream here on Susquehanna's campus that's really eroded. It's had lots of issues. I've never seen anything like it outside of an urban system. Like real deep cut banks, heavy erosion. And it's in a place where we can't really get equipment in. We can't do the typical kind of restoration you do in PA. So I thought, all right, let's try this thing that works out west. That as soon as you say beavers here, people get a little nervous. So I thought, what have we got to lose on this particular stream? So the idea is these dams are slowing down the flow as it comes through off of agricultural fields, off of a development, you know. Lots of sediment, lots of nutrients that would be flowing into the stream, they get trapped behind the dams. And it slows the flow down. These dams aren't, you know, what you'd think of as a normal dam. They don't stop everything. They just slow it down a little bit. So think of it more like a sieve, right? And we put eight of these in. So each sieve catches a little bit more of the sediment, a little bit more of the energy that's coming through, and decreases the erosion while building up the stream channel at the same time. So that's our goal in this one. It's more about stormwater management, but in general, we think about beaver dams for groundwater recharge, for, you know, creating nature's cooler in the summer. And a lot of issues around just sort of slowing down flow, slowing down energy during big storms.
Few questions. Why hasn't it caught on in the east when they're doing this out west?
That is a great question. There are some states that do it, Vermont, New Hampshire, some in Maine. Actually, one of the first people to push for this was in Vermont. But in general, I think there's this, it goes back to that, aesthetic of what a healthy stream looks like, I think. Out west where water scarcity is really a problem, the idea of groundwater regeneration is a huge driver. And I think a large part of the impetus for why these dams have become so common out west. But in the east, we don't have water scarcity. We have water overabundance most of the time. So why would we possibly want to make more standing water, more wetlands? And I think, that becomes a little counterintuitive in the east.
I understand how it creates more wetlands by the water backing up and over the banks, but how does it contribute to groundwater?
Ah, good question. So it comes down to the issue of slowing down the flow and creating more surface area for absorption of water. So, as that pond fills, think about a normal stream channel. Say it's 10 feet wide. If you create a beaver pond there that's now an acre, right? I'm not using the same units, but you get my picture, right? There's a lot more area for water to be soaked up and infiltrate the ground. And then when you have a dry spell, say that beaver pond starts to retract, it gets small, it goes back to the original channel. You've held so much water back for so long that's been able to infiltrate and saturate the ground. Now when the water's low, that water slowly will seep back out of the banks into the stream. And it's been in the ground. If you go down in your basement in the middle of summer, it's the same as being in the groundwater. You've got nice cold water re-entering the stream during the hottest, driest part of the year.
Okay, so you mentioned that one of the reasons that you wanted to do this on the stream on the campus of Susquehanna University was that, the stream that you described that looked like an urban stream, I'm picturing all kinds of erosion, steep banks, grass hanging over it, maybe some other vegetation. Is that what it looks like?
Exactly what it looks like.
Okay.
It's so bad in places that trees are essentially hanging out in space over the stream itself with no bank holding them up.
All right, so what I'm getting at is that with a changing climate and more weather events, extreme weather events, where a stream will have maybe flood water, how does an artificial beaver dam, or what impact does a beaver dam have during or after those extreme weather events?
Yeah, that is a great point. It's what actually I think is the biggest reason we should think about beaver dam analogs, beaver dams in the East, moving forward with climate change. Because, especially in this part of PA, we're expecting the same amount of rain throughout a year, right? But in bigger, fewer storms. And so if we don't have anything to slow that flow down, slow that energy down, all that rain is, it's it, we can't absorb it. The ground can't handle as much. You reach saturation and then you have sheet flow off the ground and massive storm events that push it all out into the bays. So how do we keep that water in place? Because all it's going to do is reduce groundwater if we don't start, capturing some of that. And so that's where I think beaver dams are really going to be important for that. Not to mention what I said about temperature. I think, that's a part of it that's even more overlooked because it's a double whammy. If you're in a stream and the water's down, you're stressed. If it's summer and the water's down, it's also hot because you don't have that ability to, buffer against warm temperatures. But if you've got groundwater coming in, even if it's just a little bit in springs in a few places, it creates these little cold water pockets that fish and other invertebrates can hide.
You anticipated one of my next questions. What impact is there on other species, plants, fish, other wildlife?
Yeah, there's a great bumper sticker that I saw once and I have not been able to find again that says beaver taught salmon to jump. There's this common misconception that beaver dams are barriers in streams and that they prevent migration, they prevent movement of native fishes, but they don't. They create heterogeneity. They create lots of different habitats and more diversity of habitats than exists now. Which, especially if you think about the context of climate change in a gloom and doom scenario, we want every option available to those bugs, those fish, to everything else, the aquatic plants. How are they going to adapt? And they're going to adapt to whatever habitats survive moving forward. And so we should give them as many options as possible.
Are there specific species of fish that would thrive with beaver dams?
It depends on where you are. Thinking about Pennsylvania, our state fish is brook trout. And so I often, go to brook trout because of that. Brook trout really have an intense temperature sensitivity. They can only go to so warm of temperatures, right? And they really like it colder than that anyway. So, for them, I think the real benefit here is creating that groundwater refuge, creating that cooler for the summer that keeps the warmest warms down just a little bit. And that's what's critical for fish like that. So I think, that's one species that benefits a lot from it.
Let's talk a little bit more about it, about building of beaver dams. When you actually constructed this beaver dam, how many people did you have involved, by the way?
Yeah, so we had, well, we did a couple pilot dams to start, with a few of us standing around scratching our heads because we didn't want to do that with 40 people in the room. But then when we eventually built the last six, we had partners from about 10 organizations in total, and then a couple labs on campus came out in the afternoon to help. So it ended up being about 40 to 50 people.
You actually had some people from the State Department of Environmental Protection, right?
Yeah, we had some help there that, has been amazing. They've been a great partner in looking at this and really thinking about it critically and how it's going to work in the state.
So, is it possible for maybe even people listening today to create their own beaver dam?
It depends on what state they live in.
Oh, you don't have to
Well,
go to Nevada, do you?
no. In Pennsylvania, we did this as an experiment. So they're the first ones that we know of, at least the first ones that have been permitted in the state. And we did it on this stream that only flows part of the year. It's not critical habitat for any known fish, invertebrates, anything like that. And so we're doing it here as a stormwater technique to think about how it's going to work in that condition. And as we bring up the groundwater, I'm hoping it creates perennial flow, a real stream again. And then we can start talking about how to expand out and do this in other places across the state.
So you had to get a permit.
Yes.
From who?
DEP,
DEP.
Department of Environmental Protection,
So I
yeah.
can't just go out if I have a stream in my backyard and decide I'm going to build a beaver dam.
They might frown on that a bit, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So quickly, how do you build a beaver dam?
Yeah, so, in the absence of real beavers, the challenge to me was actually finding the wood to build it to start. It takes an enormous amount of material both to build the dam and to hold it in place. So it was sort of a learning experience for me. I don't know about you, but my initial intuition was we want to build these out of as big a logs as possible, the support structures out of larger logs. Because we want them to stay there in place for a long time, right? That makes sense. Well, I did some research and it turns out the best artificial beaver dams out there, you want to use smaller stakes, maybe 2 or 3 inches in diameter out of hardwoods that will slowly decompose and the dam starts to fail after 3 or 4 years. And the idea there is that it more naturally mimics what beavers would do. They start to build a dam, it changes the way things flow, and then they decide to move somewhere else, and that dam slowly degrades. And that creates all kinds of different pockets of habitat and interesting places for bugs and fish in that stream as time moves on and the dams move around. And so we're trying to mimic that same process using stakes that are about 2 inches in diameter. We pounded them into the stream across the channel. And then normally you'd use willows or something more flexible to weave between it and almost make it look like a wicker basket with larger branches coming off the back so that when water crests over the top, it doesn't hit the ground with so much force that it scours out behind the dam and erodes the whole thing. So you want some kind of opportunity for the water to slow down before it erodes things. In our case, we have a whole bunch of Bradford pears, the invasive tree on campus. And I thought, why don't we make this a twofer? You know, let's take out some of these Bradford pears we have in abundance and use those to build the dams. So we actually sort of built this matrix of two rows of stakes and stuffed the very, very pokey, sticky, if you will, Bradford pears in between the two to capture everything that's flowing downstream. And it's working wonderfully so far.
And I'll add this, but a lot of people will listen to this and say, yeah, that's kind of a dumb thing to bring up, but I assume those stakes are not treated.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, just wanted to point that out.
No, that was actually what made it so hard to find them, because no one sells 2x2 untreated
right,
steaks.
Right, yeah, that's what I thought. Did you have any engineering students help out here as far as design the dam?
No, actually, I have been talking to a couple of students in physics, though. You know, how can we think about the force that's behind one of these dams and how much energy is actually retained? You know, how do we change what happened before to now and quantify it beyond just, you know, this is what the velocity is now, this is the velocity was then. How much water have we pushed out into the floodplain?
Yeah.
It never happened before.
So mud instead of concrete, obviously.
Yep.
Just like a real beaver.
Just like a real beaver. You know, we don't quite have the teeth and industriousness.
No,
so there were
that,
some,
yeah.
you know, some hacksaws and pickaxes involved.
The Conowingo Dam that's over the Susquehanna River in northern Maryland. Now, obviously, we're talking about a huge dam compared to a beaver dam. But right now, the Conowingo Dam, so much sediment has backed up that it isn't healthy, keeping sediment from flowing downstream. But when or does it become a negative with too much sediment at a beaver dam?
Yeah. I think that's a great question that I've actually thought about, because I think it comes down to an economy of scale, you know, and the permanence of the structure, right? So these smaller dams, you know, what I was saying of lasting only a few years sometimes, sure, there are some out there that beavers have come back to for decades, even 100 years in some cases. But most of the time they start to fail, or they fill up with sediment and the beavers abandon them after they filled up with sediment, which is the real key here. Because once they're abandoned, they'll break through and they'll recreate a new channel. You know, they'll braid through that what was once a beautiful wetland and has turned into what we call a beaver meadow. The channel reformed through that after the dam breaks. And now you're back to a single channel or maybe a braided channel through that meadow. And over time, you know, trees are going to grow there. And it's going to go back to forest the way that it was before the beavers ever showed up. That process doesn't happen with Conowingo. And I think that's the real difference, is that succession process.
Mm. So how large of a body of water do you need, or are there some limitations on where beaver dams can be built?
I have seen beaver dams on the smallest trickle of water you can imagine. And, you know, if you want to watch the most adorable videos on YouTube and go down a lost rabbit hole, you know, just look at baby beavers who've been rescued in a room. They find a blanket and shove it under the door. Like there's just this inherent, I need to stop whatever's flowing water is near me. So it doesn't really matter on the small side. On the large side, it really comes down to, you know, how much velocity comes through that system. Is it going to blow out the dam year after year? The largest beaver dam in the world is in northern Canada and stretches over a kilometer. But it stretches through really, really flat land with lots of seeps and springs feeding into it. So there isn't high velocity in that instance that would break the dam. So that's where sort of this give and take comes in.
Is there any potential for real beavers maybe adopting your fake beaver dams?
That is my dream a decade from now.
Why do you say so? What would have to happen?
Well, because there's no water in there now. It only flows part of the year. They need that year-round flow. They need that connected floodplain. So if we do our job now and we raise the stream channel up and reconnect it to the floodplain, we make this a functional stream again with flow year-round, then we might just have a chance for the beavers to come back on their
Now
own.
you're talking about your stream on campus. We only have about 30 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Is this something that we will see more of in the future?
I certainly hope so, and I'm going to do everything I can for them.
You'll be the Messiah for beaver dams, artificial beaver dams here on the East Coast. Thank you very much. Matt Wilson is Susquehanna University's Freshwater Research Institute Director. I don't know. I think this is really cool. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Coming up on the second half of the Spark Weekly, jazz pianist prodigy Connor Rohrer joins the Spark's Marques Lupton for a conversation about his start in music and his most recent tour with Samara Joy, a triple Grammy winner. You're listening to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar.
Welcome back to The Spark. I'm Marques Lupton. Mechanicsburg native and jazz pianist prodigy Connor Rohrer is in the final year at the Frost School of Music, and he is going out with a bang. In the fall, Connor was a finalist in the ultra-competitive 2023 Herbie Hancock Institute of Jazz International Piano Competition, the world's most prestigious jazz contest, and has also toured with triple Grammy winner and 2023 Best New Artist Samara Joy, and has somehow found time to join us on the Spark Weekly. It was a fantastic interview. Here it goes.
Thank you.
Well,
how are you doing?
Of course. I'm doing great. Thanks so much, Marques, for having me here.
Of course,
thank
of
you.
Course. So, yeah. So look, first question here, man. How do you do all of this?
It's a balance for sure. It's
oh,
a balance.
Yeah.
In addition to, you know, as you said, going on tour and being out of town with Samara and, you know, of course, keeping up with piano, I'm also teaching at the Frost School of Music.
Wow.
And I'm also a student at the Frost School of Music. So, you know, it's just taking it one day at a time, I guess, hour by hour,
yeah.
You know. And I love it. You know, it's a great balance and everything I'm doing is involved with music and it's my passion and you know, yes, sometimes it can be overwhelming, but it's what I love doing.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoy teaching. I enjoy playing, you know, I enjoy composing, you know, that's what I'm studying at Frost, you know, getting my master's in classical composition.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things, you know, they're all related.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't feel like I'm doing, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's all kind of, you know, it's part of me.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
There's a word that that our head of HR used today, synergy. So it seems like
yes.
all of this kind of synergizes quite nicely for you.
Absolutely. You know, and it's also, I like to think of like streamlining. It's like, okay, you know, if I'm working on this composition, you know, maybe I'm writing it for, you know, orchestra or something like that. Maybe I could use this for a solo piano thing, you know. And in fact, one of the things I'll be playing tomorrow for the concert is based on sort of an orchestration project that I had to do
oh, wow.
for school. So, you know, everything I try to, you know, I try to expedite some things. Okay, maybe I can get this done very quickly and use this for other, you know, in other formats, you know, for solo piano or something. So, you know, there's a lot of that. I end up doing that a lot, streamlining. Yeah.
So, how did you get involved with all of this? Because, you know, I'm reading your bio and you're a small town kid, you know, from
yes.
from Mechanicsburg.
Yes.
Much like myself, I'm from Lancaster County.
Yes.
And you typically see like these kind of things happen to, you know, big city kids.
Of course.
You know, so how did you get connected?
Yeah, so it's funny you ask that because, you know, at the competition, you know, I was hearing, you know, a lot of these people I've looked up to, a lot of these people I was competing with, I won't say against, I will say competing with, they're from, you know, big cities like Chicago and Houston and LA and especially New York, you know, New York, a lot of people are based in New York. I grew up in Mechanicsburg, and I will say, what this area has is a rich, I had a lot of mentorship, you know, growing up, especially with the Central Pennsylvania Friends of Jazz. You know, I was able to go to the jazz camp for a number of years. I actually started there as a trombonist.
Wow.
When I was in seventh grade. But quickly after, you know, I realized, okay, piano is the thing I want to do. I want to become an improvising pianist. Before, I had been playing classical piano and learning repertoire since I was 5 years old. So,
wow.
You know, I've been studying piano for a while, but improvisation was sort of this new thing that I was getting into going into high school. And I had quite a few good mentors that helped me along the way, namely Kirk Reese, who is, you know, a great pianist in this area, and he has taught me a lot of, I owe him a lot of, you know, to my knowledge and in the way I play, and he's opened me up to so many different concepts of playing and of course, listening to records. But also, I should mention Steve Rudolph, who was executive director of the Central Pennsylvania Friends of Jazz for many years. And he's helped me out. I've gone to his house and we've talked about music for hours. And of course, he's helped me out in terms of getting work and being able to, you know, work in this town, you know. And of course, being a musician, being a jazz musician, half of the work is done through experience of playing with people, playing with other, you know, playing with a bass player and a drummer, you know.
So, yeah.
And the other half, of course, is working diligently in the practice room, you know, I would say. So, you know, I consider myself very lucky to have those mentors in my life. And those opportunities to play early on. Yeah.
So then these programs and camps then help propel you to where you are today?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it was really just one camp, the Central Pennsylvania Friends of Jazz Camp.
Wow.
that meets, you know, every June, you know, at Messiah College.
Mm.
And that's where I got my start,
yeah.
You know. And, you know, next thing you know, I started playing with. I met two guys, Logan and Gabriel, and we formed a band named Teen Town. And of course, you know, now we're not teens anymore. Most two of us aren't teens anymore. But you know, I've been playing with them for, I guess, 7.5 years by now.
Mm.
And so that was great. You know, that's where I got my start. You know.
Oh wow.
But yeah. So yeah.
Wow. And now the Herbie Hancock competition. You mentioned there were some folks from New York and New York City. So can you describe the atmosphere of the competition in New York City? I mean, you said, you know, compete with, but I still feel like there had to be like a sense of, you know, me against you type competition. No?
Yeah, it's important to be this concept of camaraderie, you know, between musicians is so important, you know.
Yeah.
Especially musicians of the same instrument, and you know, piano is one of those instruments that, you know, people play so differently, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I was hearing, I listened to a lot of the semifinals, and a lot of people, there were 11 people in the semifinals.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were based in New York. And these are people that I've looked up to and admired, you know, in my generation, you know, people who are around my age that I've always looked up to. And just hearing them play and hearing how different each player was very intriguing to me. You know, surprisingly, I went into the competition just thinking, okay, you know what, I've prepared as much as I can. I don't usually do these competitions. I, you know, that was really my only competition in terms of jazz piano I really applied for. And so I just went in there. I just thought, you know, I'm just going to do the best I can, and not try to be in my head so much.
Yeah.
And I didn't really feel that kind of that competitive spirit of, okay, I'm going to do this. It was kind of just like, you know what? I'm just going to have fun with the band, you know? And that's the thing. It wasn't solo. I did play a solo piece, as you heard, beginning this program. I did play a solo piece for the finals, but most of the time I was playing with a drummer and a bass player.
Oh,
and
wow.
Really, I was trying to focus on enjoying, you know, my time with them and being in the moment and just really enjoying playing with them, because those musicians I was playing with were, you know, New York jazz musicians who had been around and played with many of my piano idols. So I was trying to really enjoy that. So
then how did you stay focused during that time? Because I'll tell you this, you know, if I'm at like a basketball clinic or something and you know, if Allen Iverson is like, hey, Marquise, come on over, check rock. You know, like I'm going to, you know, be excited, you know, but also like I've looked up to this person. So like my focus will be distracted with admiration. So
absolutely.
So how did you stay focused and ultimately becoming a finalist? Like that's huge.
Yeah. So I knew I was going to be nervous. Mm. First of all, I prepared myself to be, okay, you know, I'm just going to be completely nervous. Like I'm just not going to be able to think like I'm used to thinking in the moment, and I'm not going to be able to focus like I'm used to focusing. So I prepare myself for that. But in terms of playing for this panel, you know, all-star panel of my idols, you know, including Mr. Hancock himself, who was on the panel, but also other pianists like Bill Charlap, I've listened to many, many times, Hiromi, Danilo Perez, Orrin Evans. These are, you know, these pianists are you know, pillars.
Yeah.
I really wanted to cater the actual music to them. Mm. You know, so I was thinking, okay, I put a lot of time. I actually put less time into practicing and more time into deciding what tunes to play because I knew that was going to be a defining factor.
Right.
For the judges, but also for myself and how comfortable I feel. Mm. So I chose some, I played a lot of Wayne Shorter stuff because I know both Danilo and Herbie Hancock played extensively with Wayne Shorter and know his music and resonate with his music. And so it was almost like, you know, I was doing it for them, you know, which I guess that could be a little bit more nerve wracking, but for some reason it was very relaxing for me to just present that, you know, and, I was nervous. I was, you know, of course. But I was, it was kind of like one of those attitudes you have where it's like, okay, whatever happens, happens, you know, let's just do this, you know?
My old football coach would say that is called stepping up to the plate.
Exactly. Yes.
Before I go to my other questions, talking about Nerves of Steel, how did you overcome your nerves during your first performance with Samara Joy's group?
Oh, boy. Oh, gosh. So my first performance with Samara was at Sculler's Jazz Club in Boston. And I was subbing for someone who was already on the gig. And so I was approached for this opportunity not too far in advance, you know, probably about 3 or 4 weeks notice. And I had to do a lot of preparation, you know, listening to her music. Of course I knew about Samara and, you know, I knew who she was, but I wasn't really listening to her music a lot. So I really had to get caught up. And, I flew in the day of I was at school in Miami. I just started my master's and I just started, doing my teaching. I was teaching assistant for Martin Bejarano. It was the first week of school and I got notified about this and I was like, oh gosh, okay. And, I flew up the same day as the gig and we did a short rehearsal and I wasn't feeling great about it because I was just kind of, you know, I was thrown into this. Samara and I, we hadn't met in person.
Oh, wow.
That was the first time we met. And the first time, obviously, I played with her. And, you know, a lot was going through my mind. I was very stressed. I was very overwhelmed. But luckily, there was another show that night.
Yeah.
We did two shows. And I will say the second show was so much better. It was like, you know, I felt, in terms of me, in terms of the nerves and feeling, you know, I just didn't. This was my first big gig, you know. And gosh, it was so much fun that night. And then we went to we had two more gigs in different locations. It was sort of a short stint, a short tour over the weekend. So I had a couple more opportunities to play the same music and get it right.
Yeah. So how do you prep for something like this? Like do you are you in your bathroom and you're like, all right, I'm hit them off with a little staccato and then some Allegro and little bitty bitty bitty. You know, like how do you prep?
Yeah. So usually what happens is, well, sometimes it's funny you say bathroom, but sometimes I'm away from the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm on a plane or something, or maybe, you know, I've been training myself to learn how to really prepare music without being at the keyboard, because a lot of times, especially when you're on tour, there's no access to a piano unless I bring my little MIDI keyboard in my backpack. But a lot of listening and a lot of taking notes. And what I mean by notes is not actual, you know, music notation, but just writing down words saying, okay, this is where the form goes. Okay, she's going to do this. Just be ready for this. And that first gig I played with her at Scholars back in, this is September of 2022. I had this little notebook that I pulled out with all these markings and all these, you know, talking about, okay, this is when she's going to come back in. Oh, she likes to do it like this, you know, very specific details that maybe I wouldn't, you know, remember immediately, you know, just to keep myself just a little bit of a reminder, you know. So, you know, usually the case is, okay, she sends out voice memos, you know, taken from gigs that she's done already. And so I'm taking notes on like what's going on.
Okay.
You know? So, yeah, that's kind of the way it goes. But those times where I'm at the piano, of course, I'm practicing and really working out exactly what needs to happen, you know.
Always a student, I see.
Oh, of course.
Yes. So next Friday, here on the Spark, we're having a special on artificial intelligence and if it's going to in fact start taking people's jobs. So for yourself, where do you see the intersectionality of music and AI?
Wow. Okay. So, you know, I play improvised music. You know, and of course, improvised music is, you know, the basis of that is spontaneity. And, you know, I feel like it's very difficult, you know, it's a very human thing, you know, of course. I think, you know, especially in the recording studios, in mixing and mastering processes, you know, AI can play a really important role. But, you know, I go to school, you know, for music. I go to school. I'm learning all these techniques. And, you know, sometimes I kind of get a little scared, you know, when it's like, okay, you know, this, you know, some of these concepts that I'm learning, I may not need them in the future because something else is going to take care of that, you know. Technology is going to take care of that. You know, I have taken a lot of music tech classes just as part of my very versatile education of being at a university of Miami. You know, I'm not just learning jazz, you know, I'm learning a lot. But I think for this music, you know, it's human expression, you know, and spontaneity. And it's not just about the music, it's also about, you know, what we see on stage, the interaction between musicians, the conversation that's going on stage. And obviously that's impossible to really recreate through technology. So,
absolutely.
So, you know, it's a very, that visceral feeling that you get, you know, when you're seeing a live band playing and you're seeing, you know, the smiles on everyone's face and the interaction that's going on, the shouting, everything.
I'll tell you this, nothing beats that live band experience, you know, just hearing the notes and feeling that energy like that cannot be duplicated. So talking about hearing notes and feeling energy, you'll be doing much of that tomorrow.
Yes.
So can you tell us what is happening tomorrow? I mentioned it at the top of the show, but can you tell us what's happening tomorrow and what folks can expect?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm playing at the Susquehanna Art Museum tomorrow. I'm presenting some new music, some old music, some of my favorite music, solo piano, and I believe 5:30 start. There's going to be a reception right before, you know, where I'm happy to talk to people and share you know, my experience and just kind of chat. And then I'll play a 75-minute set of music. And I'm very much looking forward to this. I've played at the Susquehanna Art Museum before, and I'm playing on a very historic piano that's been played by some of the jazz greats that have passed through this town, passed through Harrisburg, and have played. And I'm really looking forward to this. My family's going to be there, and I'm sure some of my mentors might be there as well. So it's going to be a very fun time. I'm so happy to come back to my hometown and share what I've been working on.
Yeah.
And it's a really wonderful thing, and I'm really hoping a lot of people can come out and enjoy this. You know?
Now, what is the or how significant is this to you to show, you know, your hometown folks, you know, this is what I've been working on the last couple years. Yeah. You know, when I left here, I didn't have a beard. Now I have one. You know, yeah. so how essential is that for you to show the folks that seen you in your youth, to show them your growth, especially in music?
I guess it is an essential thing. I just think it's a wonderful thing after the competition, after playing with Samara, to really just come back and present what I've been working on. Yeah. So it's a very important thing. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Connor, this has been fantastic. Thank you for coming on the Spark and letting us into this prodigy world of being a jazz pianist. I know in showbiz you're not supposed to say good luck, so break a leg.
break a leg
tomorrow.
Thank you, thank you.
Yes. Thank you for coming on the Spark.
Thank you so much, Marquise.
Yes. All
right. And on behalf of Scott Lamar and myself, we want to thank you for making us a part of your day. And don't forget, later this week, we have some remarkable interviews lined up. Scott is talking food safety and inspections, and we speak with world traveler Nova Rain, and also, is AI going to take my job? So catch up with us on Friday as we dig into the world of artificial intelligence. I am Marquise Lupton. This is The Spark Weekly, and have yourself a nice day.